Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today, I am joined once again by psychedelic scholar Robert Forte. He and I are engaging a series of conversations around his influence in modern psychedelic movement offshoots. And so our last one was about MDMA, MAPS, Rick Doblin, and the FDA's recent decision to not approve the MDMA trauma therapy model that Rick Doblin had proposed. Today's podcast is about microdosing, the history of microdosing, Robert's influence on our current microdosing culture. So stay tuned for this juicy show. Before we dive in, I'm reminding you to click that subscribe button, to like, to share, to comment, to also sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com, and to buckle up and prepare to enjoy my conversation on microdosing with Robert Forte. Today we're talking about microdosing.
So that's one of the most fascinating developments for me.
I'm curious to know why.
Well, because in a way, an inadvertent way, I started this trend of microdosing, and I've been absolutely fascinated to see how it has flourished. Because it brings.
I thought I started microdosing because I started microdosing in 93. When did you start microdosing?
Well, this is the thing. Yes, microdosing was a secret that everybody knew. Mm-hmm. You know, I first heard the word microdosing, I think it was probably in the mid or late 1980s, mm-hmm. Through my dear friend Peter Stafford, who's another character we may want to get into later, but author of what to me is one of the most important books on psychedelics called The Psychedelics Encyclopedia. And he was like a big brother to me and one of my first teachers in the field. And he mentioned microdosing to me. And then I spoke with Albert Hofmann, the discoverer of LSD, about it in the late 1980s. And began to do it and, you know, try it and take very, very small bits of LSD over several days at a time in a row. And it was part, I had a practice, you know, a kind of underground practice where I was guiding people and teaching about psychedelics. And it was, the point is that it was a secret that everybody knew. Mm-hmm. I thought everybody. But, you know, if you Googled microdosing in like...
Hang on a second. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I'm going to invite you to duck, duck, go microdosing because Google is Satan.
Thank you. I don't actually use Google. What I use is Brave, but yes, awesome. Well taken. If you did a computer search for microdosing before 2011... you wouldn't get anything. It was like a word that hadn't appeared in the common lexicon. But by 2011, by the later half of 2011, suddenly it was the thing. It was the new exciting trend in psychedelia. And that's what I inadvertently sparked and watched explode. Again, like we talked about MDMA last week, how it went from something secret that responsible people were doing and learning profoundly from to like this international trend. And how that happened is something very fascinating to me. And we're going to get into that right now.
Yeah. So I'm curious to know, of course, how you sparked the microdosing. And I just want to share my experience with it a little bit. I started microdosing in 93 when I was in grad school and was dealing with insomnia. And so for me, it was like, well, as long as I'm up, I might as well have more fun. And I would do a quarter tab of acid and take all my IKEA furniture apart and then put it back together again. Probably wasn't responsible microdosing. But I noticed the same trend you did around the same time. And what struck me the most about it was people who I mean, no disrespect, but just for shorthand, we'll call them normies, who had not had any experience with psychedelics, were saying, I really want to get into microdosing. And it was so fascinating to me that they were into the verb microdosing, but it had nothing to do with what they were microdosing. Are you microdosing chaga? Are you microdosing broccoli? Are you microdosing tetracycline? Like, that seemed irrelevant. What was prioritized was just, I'm doing this thing. And then the substances were secondary. So that's kind of like my take going into this conversation. I'll have more to add. I know you have lots more to add, but take it from there, yeah. Robert.
So you're saying that these were just trend followers that were
trend followers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's let's get into this a little bit, because the I meant to send you this book. A very important book that has been part of my transformation as a psychedelic scholar is a book by a professor of media studies at University of Wisconsin, I think, and his name is Stephen Siff, S-I-F-F. And he wrote a very important book that grew out of his PhD, and it's called The Acid Hype: American News Media and the Psychedelic Experience, I believe is the subtitle.
Ooh, good subtitle.
It's a very important book. It's one of these real pivot books, mm-hmm. where you know, because we think of most of us in this field, you know, or just in public, think that psychedelics were part of this counterculture, you know, movement. But what Siff's book points out very brilliantly and scientifically is that LSD, especially in the first wave in the 50s and the 60s, was really put out by what we would now think of as the mainstream media, or even right-wing media, and particularly by Henry Luce's media empire. Mm-hmm. You know, the same people that are selling us the Cold War and the concept of American exceptionalism, and are putting out LSD into the world. Like, this is the coolest new thing. When it got a little controversial, they kind of turned on it. But the first wave of publicity was through Henry Luce's media empire. And that's very clearly shown in this book, Acid Hype. Okay, so that's good to keep in mind as we get into this idea of microdosing. So here's how the modern trend of microdosing started. Mm-hmm. Let me also preface this. Because there's a personality that's here, and his name is James Fadiman. Mm-hmm. If you Google, I just sent you a link to an article. James Fadiman is known as the father of microdosing. Okay, and Jim is was a Stanford University graduate student in the early 1960s who did his PhD on LSD. He was a student and colleague of Willis Harmon and Myron Stolaroff. And at the very end of the first wave, he was an LSD researcher. He was there at Stanford, friends with Ken Kesey and friends with Richard Alpert. Mm-hmm. And so right there, a real pioneer, real psychedelic pioneer. And I want to say, because I'm going to say some things again in this conversation about microdosing and the psychedelic movement that may seem like I'm critical or a curmudgeon or something, but or critical of Jim. So I want to just say this, Jim, I'm going to send you this podcast. Jim Fadiman is a very good friend of mine. I love Jim, and I think that he loves me too. He came to Santa Cruz, California in the kind of early 2000s or 2006 or seven, somewhere in there, because he wanted to write a book on psychedelics. And he came there and he rented a little house by the beach, and I'm living in Santa Cruz, California, and we would meet up regularly, you know, first maybe, you know, a couple times a month or once a month, but for several years, it was one of my favorite things to do, to call Jim up and say, hey, let's get together. And we'd meet at the Golden Buddha, or we'd meet at the cafe, and we would tell stories about psychedelics. And this is while he was writing his book. And he credits me in his book. He gives me a very flattering acknowledgement in the book, like comparing me to the psychedelic people like Aldous Huxley and Timothy Leary in the acknowledgments in his grid. So like we love each other and I really appreciate him. And so one day as he's finishing up his book, we meet for coffee and he says he's having a little trouble. He's having a little writer's block, how to like wrap it all up. And I say, why don't you just try microdosing? And he looks at me like he's never heard microdosing. He says, what's that? And I said, you don't know what microdosing is? I mean, everybody knows microdosing. And he says, no, I have no, what is microdosing? And so I explained to him, it's, you know, a little bits of LSD every day for a while. And the next time we meet, I bring him the little Visine bottle that's measured out so that each drop is just 10 micrograms. And then a couple of weeks later, we meet again and he says, whoa, he says, this is funny, in light of our conversation last week, he says, boy, I hope I don't do a Rick Doblin on you. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, you know, this microdosing is very fascinating. I think I'm going to, you know, do a project or research it or run with it. I forget exactly what he said, but.
What year was this?
This was like 2010 or 2011.
And so he was clued in. Was he clued into the Doblin thing from your experience?
Oh yeah, sure. No, Jim and I had very thorough, intimate conversations about all aspects of life and psychedelics. He was like a big brother to me. We talked about every single thing. He knew exactly how I felt about all this stuff, fully informed, and a great listener and very responsive and really one of the most important friendships that I've had in the psychedelic world. And so he says that, I hope I don't do a Doblin on you. And I was like, what does that mean? I laugh. And so this is the thing. Almost immediately after his book is published, maybe even before his book is published, we start to see this like fluttering up of articles about microdosing. About, you know, and you, again, a person really wants to do a project on this, write a social history of the psychedelic renaissance, we'll see. And suddenly there's this flurry of articles, take LSD and become can LSD make you a billionaire? And then suddenly about all this wave of all these, you know, smart techie guys over the hill in the Silicon Valley taking LSD and Steve Jobs taking LSD and then microdosing LSD and Albert Hofmann, who lived to be 102 years old, like used my, and now LSD will not only make you rich, but LSD will make you live longer. And it will help every single thing in your life. This whole wave of media or acid hype is what Stephen Siff called it, you know, right at the time that this is where Jim is kind of releasing this concept. But to me, you know, and I want to say this too, because I have a theory about this. I have a conspiracy theory about this, that there is a, you know, that you've seen these video montages of modern media where everybody gets a script and they're saying it in Cleveland, they're saying it in Southern California, they're saying it all over the world. There's like, here's your script. And the LSD microdosing was put into that script, and suddenly we saw this.
I just want to mention, and for the record, we're recording this on October 8th, they've inserted MK Ultra into the alt media script in the past month. So just to give our audience an example of this, everyone got their talking points, and now that phrase is being repeated over and over and over again. But. Mm-hmm. Going back to microdosing being inserted into the media script.
So microdosing was inserted and it was a kind of lower dose acid hype. Mm-hmm. And like industry, and then whole industry strung up. You know, people, you can Google, you can pay somebody $3,000 to be your microdosing coach
who will. What?
Yeah. There's one, yeah, there are these microdosing coaches. There's a whole business, microdosing this, microdosing that. First, it started with LSD. Mm-hmm. And So I'm suspicious about that, about this flourishing, this sociological flourishing of something like that.
Were you the one who created the term microdosing? Where did that come from?
No, I first heard that term from Peter Stafford,
Okay.
back in, the early 1980s when I was first learning about this. We talked about when we were taking LSD, you would take a microdose, or you would take a museum dose that was like 100 micrograms. So you'd either go to the museum or you'd see, archetypes of religious iconography on the walls, or there would be a psychedelic dose. Those were the kind of the three doses.
At that time, was there any sort of discussion of like that it might be kind of candy ass to be microdosing if people hadn't done macro psychedelic doses?
No, it wasn't. It was just kind of a cool thing to do.
And we're frozen. And we're still frozen. And I'm gonna wait it out. And we're back to just me. So I'm gonna pause and hope that Robert comes back. Oh, you're still on mute.
Sorry, I meant to just turn off my ringer, but I turned off my whole phone and my hotspot, so we're better now.
No problem. The last thing we heard was it was just a fun thing to do.
Yeah, it was a fun thing to do, but also we would notice interesting things about it. There's a whole world of possibilities in this concept of microdosing, from it being just merely a placebo response to actual clinical effects in a wide range of things. For example, very small doses of LSD or psilocybin can help with cluster headaches and migraine headaches. That's
I
one
have heard
thing.
that.
There's a pharmacological reason for that, and it's kind of tragic that real formal research into this has been blocked by the Controlled Substance Act and very difficult to accomplish, but that's a real positive thing.
People with cluster headaches have an alarmingly high instance of suicide because they're supposed to be so painful.
Brutal, brutal. Yeah, migraines and cluster headaches, which are kind of the same and kind of different. They're brutal, and
What were the some of the benefits that you yourself were experiencing from microdosing?
Well, honestly, none. I mean, myself, I didn't really notice any. But that's like if you ask me what benefits that I received from psychedelics overall, and I had interesting experiences, but it didn't really change me from I was a natural mystic since I was a kid. I just got to see more intensely into supernatural realities. But at least for an example, microdosing, the first time I actually did it, I overdosed a little bit. So it wasn't really a microdose, but it was a very small amount. And I went out and played golf. And I played the single best round that I've played on that extremely difficult course in Northern California at Fort Ord, the military base. And I played in the wind on a cold, cold day in December, rainy, windy. And I shot a 73. It was like unheard of, excellent round. And it was because the LSD was in my system and I could feel it. It was slight, but I could really feel it. And I was more like fascinated with my feeling, really present with my feeling, my body, and not like mentally thinking about how to play the game or the swing. I was in a zone for playing. I wasn't even aware of what I was shooting. like that. But then when I tried to replicate it, it wasn't quite as effective. And golf is a really good sport to do these kinds of tests with. And because so now let's get back to the thread here. Jim popularizes microdosing, and popularizes it partly by offering all this anecdotal evidence for how great it is, as if it's scientific research, but it's not scientific research. It was just like advertising.
Through like anybody, what channels was he offering this anecdotal evidence?
Well, like I said, it was coming out through the media.
Got it.
Fox News, The Economist, CNN, you know, all these.
And all tied back to Fadiman.
Fadiman was kind of the, you know, it launched a whole new career for him. Like Rick Doblin was the MDMA guy. Jim Fadiman is the microdosing guy.
I know you're taking us on a journey, but when he said, "I hope I don't pull a Doblin on you," did your spidey sense go up? Because it makes it seem like he's not in control. That statement seems a little odd.
You know, you should get Jim on. You should do a podcast with Jim. In fact, a book is coming out. Is it already out, or it's coming out soon, on the science of microdosing? And okay. Jim is a co-author, and he might be up for that. And that'd be a question. You know, we could do something together.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Because again, we are. I consider him a dear friend. I'm quite sure he considers me that. He does. He warns me about my conspiracy theories. He thinks that I go too far. But here's an example that I want to tell this story. So a few years after this whole thing with microdosing happens, and I tell him, "Jim, it sounds like, you know, like you have your finger right on the whole, you know, media. I mean, that's like, see, are you working for the CIA, Jim? Come on, tell me the truth." Mm-hmm. And here's what he said. And I believe him, mostly. He said, Robert, I'm not working for the CIA. And I said, okay. He said, to be honest with you, the CIA did approach me, and they asked me to work for them in the psychedelic space. And I said, what's in it for me? And I didn't like their answer, so I told them no. Now, this is a kind of common thing you hear from people that you suspect, oh yeah, they interviewed me, but I didn't want to work for them. So he said he didn't want to work for them, and I believe.
But it wasn't a moral reason. But it wasn't a moral reason why he didn't want to work for him. They didn't sweeten the pot enough for him.
Yeah, I know. He said no. But here's what it left me with. Because it opens up the whole subject. Because do you think that Jim Fadiman is the only person in the psychedelic space that the CIA offered a job to? Of course not. Of course not. So who? Then it opens a question like, who did they ask? Who did they invite to work for them? Who said yes? And to me, that opens up.
Isn't it everyone who's famous? I feel like at this point, everyone who gets that level of fame is pretty much controlled. I have his Wikipedia dialed up. Like, he's out of Harvard. He's out of Stanford. Everyone knows his name at this point. You and I know how controlled the media space is. No one ekes through accidentally.
Well, and you forgot to mention that the Stanford project that he comes out of from the 60s with Willis Harmon and the Institute for Advanced International something. There's two places back there, but they were CIA connected. And but I, again, as I said last week, I can only go by my own direct personal experience. I can have my suspicions, but what I can only say publicly is I don't. You know, he's my friend, and he told me he didn't. And so I'm going to go with that. But okay. I think it invites the question, who else? And how do we, and we, you know, maybe we want to talk about some individuals now. We could, that I know that Jim is affiliated with. You know, we talked about Doblin. There is, look, let's just face it. I call it the enterprise. There's a small group of people who are connected to governments, who connected to intelligence agencies, who are connected with money, who are behind this thing we call the psychedelic renaissance, what Stephen Siff called acid hype, which it's like psychedelic hype, and why they're doing that and how exactly they're doing that, you know, we've been looking at over the, you know, past couple of years in our podcasts. But the microdosing money.
Just really quick, please. In what year did you ask him if he was working for the CIA?
Oh, that was a few years later. That was probably, I think that was around 2018.
I'm also learning more and more. There's quite a difference between working for the CIA, working mm-hmm. with the CIA, mm-hmm. you know, people mm-hmm. who aren't directly on the payroll, but are somehow associated.
Yeah. Yeah, people that, you know, do this kind of work, you know, they talk about the difference between a CIA agent, a CIA asset, you know, then there's useful idiots, you know, there's a whole, it's a fascinating field and of inquiry that I'm delighted that more and more people are really getting into. It's also what you said at the beginning, very interesting that now this is being put out in the media as a thing, you know, MK Ultra. There was that show with Winona Ryder, Stranger Things, you know, that got into some of this stuff.
But the phrase itself has mostly been for those who are demonized as conspiracy theorists. And I've watched in the past month where it's getting more mainstream traction. They're opening the guardrails for some reason. The usual suspects that you and I talk about, you know, and no, are all of a sudden inserting it into their media appearances.
Yeah. Well, it wouldn't surprise me if people like that pay attention to people that are, you know, at the leading wave of dissent and learn what they're saying and then try to weave it into their dialogue.
But you know, there's like also the wellness company. Most of them are sponsored by or affiliated by the wellness company, which Amazing Polly has shown us is an intelligence agency. So if they're all being controlled by their advertiser, it's not too far-fetched that they're getting certain talking points, that they might be getting bonuses for mentions of certain phrases. Granted, this is conjecture, right? But I'm just noticing that this phrase, which used to be like, oh, you're a crazy conspiracy theorist, is now rolling off the tongue of all the alt media darlings who everyone is hoping will rescue us.
So then we have to, the question comes up by people that are genuinely curious about, like, why would the CIA want to popularize LSD? Why would they hype LSD? Like, you know, don't we all know that this is, you know, makes people independent thinkers or, you know, problems for the government? Like, why would they do this? And so that's a concept that we really need to look at and question, because there's it's important. And I don't know if you had time before we started this conversation to look at your text. I sent you this little video. Okay, so your listeners, maybe when you do the video, you can insert this in here. I may have mentioned it when I do podcasts, but I don't know if you and I have talked about it. But it's really a hilarious little 2-minute video that's called LSD being tested on British troops.
Okay.
And it's a little grainy black and white. I don't know if it's authentic, but it shows purportedly a dosing of British troops doing their training, and they're you know, they're marching all in straight line. They're given LSD and they start out marching in straight lines and following orders and doing all the things with the guns. And then as the LSD takes effect, they start laughing, you know, they can't walk in straight lines. They go and they hug trees. And in this cute little video has circulated in the psychedelic, you know, media as an example of, see, this is why LSD, this is why we should put LSD in the water supply, because how it's such an anti-war tool, you know, soldiers can't fight. You know, if everybody just was tripping on LSD, we'd all be hugging trees and laughing. Mm-hmm. Well, That's what happened to the anti-war movement in the 60s. It deteriorated from a group of politically intelligent, you know, good students at the best schools, organizing voters, you know, having talks, the Students for a Democratic Society. And then when they started to become, you know, kind of effective in the early part of the 60s, suddenly there's this wave of psychedelic drugs and a group called the Weathermen Underground, which really radicalized the anti-war movement and went from, it went from registering voters to encircling the Pentagon and trying to levitate the Pentagon. And all this, you know, the sexual movement and the Weather Underground were notorious for their, you know, their drugs and their open relationships and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it really turned the mainstream against the anti-war movement. It radicalized it. And so, you know, fast forward to today, you know, microdosing, it's a way to, you know, it's like to treat depression. People are hyping microdosing like this is a way to treat depression. And, you know, what's depression? But I mean, there are different kinds of depression, of course, but like this epidemic of depression is really, a study came out in the UK not long ago. It's a socioeconomic condition. Like people are depressed because they don't have a pot to piss in. You know, their communities are, you know, the jobs are outsourced or the economy is fucked and they feel hopeless. And so, you know, what are you going to do about that? Well, if you're in the power structure, what you want to do about that is just drug them. This is, again, Huxley's point. Give them some drugs and just happify them and distract them with like, oh, look at how I'm, you know, turn it inward. Get him into some new age psychology thing. Get him meditating. Get him thinking that, you know, it's all their own responsibility. And though it is largely often, you know, I'm not, it's complicated. It's not a simple thing because it is our responsibility to be aware of how we create our experience and things of this sort. But there are also social injustices which are being inflicted upon society by an organized elite. And these are the ones that are, you know, propping LSD, hyping LSD and throwing it out there in the society, and not just LSD, but all the psychedelics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's no clinical evidence at all, really, to argue for the administration of LSD for depression. It's just placebo. It's just suggestion. And it is being advertised, you know, uncritically. And, you know, I just find that really fascinating.
Agreed. I mean, what you mentioned about the what it's called the Weathermen Underground. And I know we talked about this when we did our show with Emily on Leary, but this is the marker that we've seen of both the psychedelic and the New Age movements from the get-go, is there is no out there. Don't take any external action to fix the world. It's all in your mind. We see this coming from, you know, Robert Edward Grant and that kind of new crop that's popping up around Aubrey and those people. And as far as, and I'm sure you're going to take us into it, but our government thrives on mind control. Like they love ways to generate, you know, consensus, to get people to acquiesce. So if you have direct access to their minds by way of a chemically created substance, like what a phenomenal way to control the populace.
Exactly. Yep. That's it. And it's not, you know, it's just reached its most kind of sophisticated and deceptive in the modern world. But of course, the use of drugs to control populations goes, or distractions, you know, the bread and circus. This is a time-honored tradition. It's just reached a real crescendo here in the United States now. And that's an important thing to look at and, you know, try to make sense of. Also very frustrating, but
so frustrating for those of us. I mean, you've been in it obviously far longer than I have, but those of us who have been walking our own psychedelic path for so long and seeing people getting excited about decriminalization, making things legal. Now, granted, it's great for the people who have been wrongfully incarcerated for sharing these drugs and these substances with people. But for me, my spidey senses were up immediately. Like, I don't want the government involved in my drugs. I don't like, you know, it being so as easy as it is and everything being run through their grimy fingers before it hits the public. That is more concerning to me than meeting, you know, a sketchy drug dealer in the Alpha Beta parking lot. I'd rather take those chances than they take the chances with my government.
Yep. Well, me too. Unfortunately, they're even sort of blended in the underground. We're starting to learn that a lot of these kind of famous, you know, hippie mafias, the famous one is, of course, the Brotherhood of Eternal Love, which is before your time. It's before my time. It was in the mid-60s. Mm-hmm. And when the first flourishing of psychedelic drugs, you know, characters like Augustus Stanley Owsley, known as Bear, or Nick Sand, who was a good friend of mine, these famous acid chemists who made the famous orange sunshine that, you know, turned on the 60s. You know, there's a lot of material to that argues well that these are also government operations. I've talked with a number of chemists who say, yeah, well, the precursors came to us from, you know, G-men. You know, you could tell by their shoes, and they were, you know, they would deliver, you know, materials for psychedelics. It were just a couple of simple steps to turn it into DMT or LSD and make it look like it came from these, you know, chemists like Nick and Owsley. And the real story is a lot more interesting than that. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's going to be fascinating to watch because it's more and more people are becoming aware of the kinds of conversations that you and I have been having for several years now. Yeah. And, you know, what is going to happen when people face the fact that they've been tricked again by the government? And, you know, what are these? It's going to be a difficult switch because people who have taken a lot of these psychedelic drugs have a real investment in the experiences that they've caused. Mm-hmm. They're often, as you know, we love psychedelic drugs, but anybody that's taken them over a period of time, even very systematically, knows that they're not all blissful. You know, they're experiences that cause you to confront some very difficult material and confusion and temporary ill health or depression, you know. And so there's a real, it's they're very important studies that were done in the 60s called the severity of initiation. Mm-hmm. Interesting set of studies that showed that the more you suffer for a certain thing, like a fraternity hazing for it to get into the more you suffer, the more severe your initiation, the more you like that thing that you suffered for. And so, you know, I think about this with, in my own journey with psychedelics. You know, one time I was down in, I made half a dozen trips to Peru to drink ayahuasca for, you know, several weeks in a row. And I was just down there one time, and it's, you know, in the early days when I was doing this in the, 25 years ago, there weren't really any cushy places to go take ayahuasca. When you went down there, you found yourself, you know, on a mud on the ground. There are mosquitoes. It smells like shit because they don't really know what to do with their sewage yet. You know, it's a very arduous process to do this and then take ayahuasca, which is the worst tasting stuff in the world, as you probably know, and it makes you vomit and it makes you shit. And you're going through all this ordeal, everybody that did it, and yet they come back saying, my God, this was the best thing I ever did for myself. And that's when I started thinking of these severity of initiation studies. Really? Was it the best thing you ever did for yourself? Kind of like Burning Man. People go to Burning Man. They spend people that don't have a lot of discretionary income will spend hundreds of dollars on a ticket. They'll spend months preparing some sort of art sort of thing. They'll travel. They'll get stuck in traffic for 10 hours. They'll camp out in some of the most, you know, inhospitable conditions of, you know, wind storms and rainstorms and heat and cold, and stand in line for an hour to take a shit in the morning. And you're on drugs a lot of the time. And it's like, I went to Burning Man once and I thought, man, I'm never going there again. That was an ordeal. That was hardship. And I was in a cushy place in an air-conditioned trailer with food flowing in every day. Like, I just thought, I was never going to go here again. But the more harsh, and I do this kind of informal study. I'd ask people after each Burning Man, like, the last one was like the hardest for people, right? It was, but they, you know, people would say, no, this is what Burning Man is about. You know, I can't wait to go back. That was the greatest one I ever did. You know, that's the sort of cognitive dissonance that, and it's the same. I think it's, you'll see the same thing with psychedelics, people taking psychedelics, going through 8 hours of confusion and disorientation. And, you know, remember the first line of research was that these were drugs that made you temporarily crazy.
Right.
It induced a transient psychosis. And,
well, I'm curious about the severity of initiation and if it only applies to people's first ayahuasca journeys, to people's first Burning Man. And I also wonder if there's a correlation to people here in the West who don't have rituals or initiations that allow them to rely on themselves, that allow them to connect with a deeper purpose or a deeper connection. I don't know. I mean, I've had great Burning Man experiences and I've had terrible Burning Man experiences. And I stopped going in 2009 because I thought it all seemed too crowded and too hectic. But I also see in terms of the ways that like the government is using these drugs and you know, doubling down on getting them into the public. Emily and I have talked before about these kind of alt media bromances that seem to be forged through psychedelics and then create these seemingly very close bonds where we see people who are clearly selling their ideals, morality, and ethics down the river, but because of whatever happened during some drug state in ceremony, now they feel an allegiance to the people mm-hmm. who gave them the drugs. And this is something that we're, you know, this is not hard to find evidence of. We see, you know, podcasters talking about it quite openly.
Yep. Yeah. Well, it's, again, it's a kind of common model. It's how cults are formed. You know, you lead someone into initiation, you give them drugs. There is a sense of communitas. They're often mystical experiences. There are sometimes, you know, breakthroughs, like psychological breakthroughs. And yeah, that's all part of it. It's, again, to just step back a little further, religion is like that generally. The history of religion is like that generally. There's a lot of good in there, but then it gets mixed up in, you know, institutional forms, and it becomes not about opening and expanding consciousness, but kind of contracting it and controlling it, right?
It's the control, because these people are in such open states. So I feel like when the mind is that open, when we're that open, different things can come in and steer the trips in certain ways, drop in certain ideas. You know, we're in very vulnerable places. And I see, you know, Aubrey Marcus used to, I don't think he's doing it this year, but he had something called Arcadia, these large scale festivals where they say on the website, drugs are going to be administered. These people are tripping with God knows how many people, where are the drugs coming from, what is being allowed in, even if it's at the level of like a frequency that we can't hear with our naked ear, but is informing and affecting us during those trips. There are just so many variables that can come in when we're on psychedelics. And it seems like a tremendous opportunity for those who would seek to control us.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a whole, you know, younger generation, you know, I think there's 10 or so years between us, but there's people that are even 20 years younger than you that are being lured into this. You know, the psychedelic branding, like this will, you know, they float out these studies. Well, psychedelics will help you become more in tune with nature, or they'll make you less authoritarian, or they use this branding of this product to lure people in, to get them into these cults that have a kind of dogma. You know, there are certain things like you shouldn't, you know, some of our favorite subjects, whatever, like geoengineering you know, the conspiracies of the assassinations or 9/11 or the Nord Stream pipeline, you know, like these things that with just a little inquiry can show you a way into this madhouse and a way out. Those are, you know, not okay. And the certain leading podcasters that we've talked about, the Jordan Petersons, and, you know, I have never met these guys yet. I'm kind of just reserving my response to you because I'd really like to get into the same room with someone like Joe Rogan or Aubrey Marcus and have this kind of conversation because, you know, build on what we have in common, which is an enthusiasm and a respect for the liberation of consciousness.
Yes.
And, you know, a kind of humanism to really try to promote a more widespread humanism to be anti-war and, you know, see it again, like we were saying before, there are levels of this. There are some people that are just going along with it. Some people are more like more operatives.
Yep.
And I don't like Aubrey Marcus. I've just had a few exchanges with him. An invitation to appear on his show. They've all been very cordial. You know, he's a highly intelligent man. I'm sure we would have a lot of laughs. He said he'd listened to other podcasts I've done. You know, there was a rapport, let's get you on. And, you know, I have a thing going with Daniel Pinchbeck, who is, you know, a person who is, you know, there's some very, very likable things about Daniel. I connected with him recently in the UK. And then there's also a kind of formula to his writing that seems like he's herding people into these way of thinking and away from that way of thinking. But, you know, if you're really going to be a skeptic and an intellectual, then it's really, you need to be open-minded and look critically at all aspects of your.
Yeah, and I haven't spoken to Daniel in quite a long time, but I know, you know, for several years he had issues with me thinking differently from the way he thought. And there was not only no tolerance, but a very aggressive effort to get me to shut the hell up and start talking about the things that he thought were important, which to me just didn't make sense because I was a fan of his. I loved his books. I went to his lectures at Burning Man. I wrote for Reality Sandwich in the early days. Like, it just didn't make sense to me. I was like, this doesn't line up, you know, because in my experience, the more psychedelics we do, the more open and expansive we become and more tolerant of ideas that might differ from the mainstream. So for me, it didn't make sense and always had me wondering if he was controlled. I don't know. But I certainly support you being on Joe Rogan, Aubrey Marcus, all these shows. I think that they would benefit from having your wisdom there. How do you see the current microdosing trend, either or both, working against the public, the psychedelic movement, the authentic psychedelic movement, and how do you see it serving the controllers, if this is how you see it operating at all?
Well, I kind of said that before. I think that the way it serves the power structure is as fairy dust. You know, mm-hmm. It's like positive psychology. Oh, you're depressed? Oh, here, we'll just, you know, take this. Mm-hmm. You'll see your colors will be brighter. You know, mm-hmm. a best-selling book. I listened Ilette Waldman wrote, who is a best-selling author, novelist, wrote a book, A Very Good Day. Mm-hmm. I guess she suffered from some kind of bipolar depressive disorder. And she heard Jim give a talk and got into microdosing, and it changed her life. And she wrote a best-selling book about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to steer away from the shadow into happiness. It's a way to happify people. It also gives the appearance to that the United States is a progressive, liberal, humanistic kind of place. Like, look, they talk about LSD, right, openly in the newspapers now, and the government is approving all of this research. We can't be a fascist, you know, totalitarian, authoritarian, military dictatorship. They don't do stuff like that. Well, actually, they do, and that's how they've been doing it since, you know, the Roman days and the bread and circus, and you know, so that's how it serves. You know, it's kind of working. You know, you look at people that are into microdosing, they're really, you know, you could do this research if you were patient, you know, and you could show like people who are into microdosing are not into conspiracy theories. You know,
Is
they're
this
going to
true?
be. No, I'm suggesting that as a hypothesis.
Right. So my friend Bette Williams, who I mentioned on our last show, she wrote The Wild Kindness. Her perspective, and I hope I'm getting this right, but is basically like, don't go mucking around with microdosing if you haven't macroed first. And again, I'm interpreting, but it seems like she's kind of translating for the spirit of the mushroom that like isn't really appreciating the kind of pansy ass tiptoeing around. And it is something that I see in our culture where people just want the upside. Just like you said, they just want the happy. They don't want to look at their shit. They don't want to have to confront the areas where they need to take responsibility, which a heroic dose will take us directly into. And then you have these people, like, I don't know if you've seen Mark Zuckerberg lately. Have you seen Mark Zuckerberg 2.0? He's
No.
clearly into either psychedelics or microdosing. I don't know what it is, but his
Yeah.
hair's all grown out like a hippie, and he's wearing beads, and he's got this whole new version of himself.
Huh.
And so I see a lot of people like kind of claiming to be these psychedelic explorers when they're like dipping a toe in and not really going through, you know, the puking, the sobbing, you know, the mortification of seeing the worst parts of ourselves, like all of that being totally skipped over. Do you have a take on that?
Well, I haven't seen Zuckerberg, but I have a trouble with his name, you know, the Klaus Schwab's that little.
Oh, Noah Yuval Harari.
Yeah, so you've heard him talk
Klaus
about
Schwab's
this.
familiar.
Yeah, the useless eaters. We have too many useless eaters. There are too many, and you know, their videos. You can hear him saying, you know, like what people like. He's some brilliant guy. We got to ask him what to do, and he
right.
says, well, you know, we have video games. We should give them video games and drugs, and just get them out of our way. And so I can imagine that Mark Zuckerberg is one of the models for this. Like, I'm the cool guy, and this is what you do. You just can wear these beads and fluff up your hair.
Yeah.
And sure enough, some point he may make a comment about the psychedelics and how that's useful. And there'll be waves of young people that somehow think that he's a great human being. You know, Steve Jobs was an earlier version of that. They still pulled the Steve Jobs thing, like Steve Jobs was some sort of great American, some great humanist. And, you know, nobody really wants to look, very few people, except the ones who knew him, you know, want to look critically at what sort of, you know, real son of a bitch he was. And if he took LSD, and like that would be like, I don't want to go near LSD.
That does it for the first half of my conversation on microdosing with Robert Forte. As you are inspired to pick up, tune into the second half, you can find that over on both my Locals and Patreon communities. Those addresses are dannykatz.locals.com and patreon.com/dannykatz. At both of those communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, my post-show throwdowns, oodles of bonus content, plus the knowledge that you are supporting a content creator in keeping on keeping on. I'm also reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. and reminding you to head on over to my website to explore my various offerings, my books, my webinars, my pop propaganda media literacy course for teens and grownups alike. You can also learn about one-on-one coaching with me, as well as my languaging expert consulting services. Thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Locals and the Patreon. Have a rockin' day.